All right, it's Alex Zub joining today. Thank you so much for being here for Growth and Career Pathing.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you start off talking about your career history since day zero?
Sure. I always find it really interesting to go a little bit deep into how things came together for me. I was born and raised in a town in the middle of nowhere in Siberia. The town is called Omsk. It's actually not very small. It's about 1 million people. Not very developed, no startups, essentially, especially when I was growing up, no technology companies outside of dev shops. And so on. The role of, or the job of software developer was not really a thing very much when I was growing up, but somehow started learning software development in middle school. I was lucky enough that my school had classes, IT classes that introduced to this concept. And at some point I started pinging my dad to bring the books from his from the library from his job, so that I could tinker with Basic and Visual Basic and Delphi and try to put something together at my own time, never thinking about it becoming a career or anything really big. That over time, by high school, turned into doing small software development projects for myself, for fun, for other folks. I've launched a couple of websites about things that I was passionate about that were fairly popular. Then I did a couple of paid projects for local dev shops. And most development companies were working for a typically US-based company, sometimes a Europe or Australia-based company. After those couple of projects with my mentor, we found an LA-based marketing ad agency that decided to make a move from physical to digital. So they were looking for a small team for a couple of developers to build the websites for their clients. And so web was my first and primary thing. I was primarily focused on front end. My mentor, who was essentially my partner in this collaboration with this ad agency, he was doing a lot of back end development. Over time, I had to learn both front end and back end. Back then was PHP for the most part on the back end, and a set of jQuery and instead of HTML and CSS3 was becoming popular and actually a thing back then, HTML5 as well. And over time, we've built many, many websites, basically marketing sites for restaurants, for all kinds of companies, for hotels, for real estate agents even. And so all of that was done without necessarily a technical leader above me and my partner there. So there was no career path, there was no growth, there was nothing that is like was formally defined. We were very much self-driven, and we were working primarily with the project managers and account managers of that agency. So we had to. Any professional development, any growth had to be very much self-imposed. We had to come up with what we want to learn. We had to learn it ourselves, and we were implementing it in the work without anybody at our client's organization being able to tell us, you know, what to do, or even them being able to control the quality in any way or form or fashion. So that was kind of interesting. And actually that theme of me not necessarily having a technical leader above me is ended up being the thing for all of my career. So my partner and I split, and then I engaged personally, individually with somebody who was based in Austin, Texas, We worked together fairly productively as freelancers. He used to be a software developer as well. And then he turned into a combination of business development, project management, account management, all of those things for himself, me, and a couple of design freelancers that he also had a part of this kind of freelance team. But then again, there was no formal, technical leadership above me, and the story of having to figure things out myself had continued. By that point, I was still in Omsk in Siberia, and I had never worked in a formal office environment. Even I had no idea what it's like. I had no desire to have an office environment either. And so the first, when working with this person from Austin, I was always intending to stay remote. And at some point we had too many projects for me personally to handle. I was the sole developer when we started. And then I had built a network of 8 to 10 freelancers with whom we worked, who were front-end, back-end developers, WordPress developers. So we continued building projects, for the most part marketing sites, but also roughly 20 to 30% of projects were actual digital products, e-commerce, and things that were different kinds of subscription and membership services and so on. So all of that started roughly 9 years ago. 8 years ago, we decided to make it formal and actually to make it official and turn it into a business, into a digital agency business. Was me, that person, John, and he had a couple of designer friends. And so four of us were the founders. We're still together. We are the partners in the company. So we started 8 years ago. I had my team of freelancers, and after coming over to the US and seeing what the folks here had built in terms of a small team of designers working together, being really collaborative and creative, coming up with ideas and turning them into finalized designs that can be actually used to build things that my developers, my engineers can actually build. Seeing all of that, I ended up turning what was a group of freelancers and where everybody was remote into a local office in Omsk with the engineers who I found locally, and we were all working out of the office. So that was my first experience working out of office, and was my first experience hiring people in person, and that's where most of my experience in growth and career pathing for other people had started to build up. Again, no formal technical leader above me, and not necessarily a strong continuous mentor to work with to learn things. So most of the things I ended up learning from practice, really. Most of the things I learned from practice. A lot of the things I learned from a leadership and management course. There's a fairly popular course in Russia called Strataplan, which I don't think anybody who's listening to this will know, but it has become very popular in Russia over the years. Back then, they were only starting out, and I learned a lot of things about managing the team, managing projects, being a part of the business from that as well, and had a was able to apply it in the company. Shortly after we started, a couple of years in, I stopped coding altogether and stopped directly being a contributor in projects, and my role turned into leadership and management. Fully, pretty much 100%.
What a great story. So why don't you talk a little bit about what it was like going from being an individual contributor to, you know, the first management role that you had? And you mentioned you had taken a course in management and leadership, but what other kinds of skills did you have to learn along the way? And what was that experience like for you?
Great question. Looking back right now, I would have thought that that experience must have been painful. It was not as painful for me back then, actually. And in the moment, it was very smooth. And the transition was, or seemed to me very easy. Although right now, looking back at it, there's definitely a lot of things that I had learned over time. There's a lot of mistakes that I made. So over those 2-3 years when I was slowly turning from IC to a manager, not because somebody appointed me as a manager, but because I had to learn it for the sake of my own sanity and for the sake of me, you know, being able to not work extremely long hours and for my team to be effective, I did have to learn things. One of the hardest things perhaps for me was letting go of control and trusting people. I'm a perfectionist by nature. There's some extent of OCD, and I things have changed over time, and I learned not to go too much into the world of being a perfectionist. But back then, it was really difficult for me to let people make their own decisions and having make sure they have the freedom to make their own informed decisions and let them fail, when, especially when the stakes are not as high, and actually giving people the freedom to fail. That is something that is not necessarily always intuitive. I had to learn it from practice. I learned it from the partially in theory from the management course I've taken and from various books, but applying in practice was definitely difficult and not easy for me. And I think still to this point, perhaps this is the most challenging part for me personally, is finding the right ways of making sure my team members are set up for success and have the right level of freedom, at the same time have the right level of supervision, and where I have the ability, or other people have the ability to nudge and course correct when needed.
Yeah, I'd say that delegation and what people are calling walking away from the keyboard are two common themes that have been happening a lot during this series, you know, and it's because so many of the people in this role have been engineers and individual contributors earlier in their time. In fact, only 1 out of 20 people so far came out of management school. Every single other person in this role has been an engineer, right? So it's a common theme, actually, like letting go of the keyboard and, you know, being able to delegate and let people fail fast and iterate and accelerate their learnings, you know, et cetera. Cool. So
I have another quick note to kind of add on to my transition. One other thing that has happened to me is, with my team, and all my team, and I was based in Omsk in Russia, but I got to visit the US, I got to visit the team here, and here in Austin, Texas is where all of essentially business was happening. That's where business development is, that's where core design services of our agency are, and being exposed to this was actually really critical and important to me. Actually understanding the business, understanding how things work, understanding our clients, understanding how our clients make decisions, and understanding how, you know, what's happening with our clients throughout the course of an engagement and after the engagement was really a turning point for me. Being involved in a number of design projects, and I made a point to be involved in IC in design projects as essentially part of the design team, was really important for me to understand that the world does not revolve around engineering. The world does not necessarily revolve around, you know, every single piece of code being perfect.
Right.
It's nice to have, but that's not what really solves people's and businesses' problems. And so a lot of that exposure helped me over time flip that switch from we need to leverage technology, and as a team, and every team member needs to understand that what we are doing is we are leveraging technology and leveraging our skills and capabilities to help other businesses, to help our clients achieve their goals.
Yeah.
And whereas writing code and writing perfect code, while it is great and gratifying, that's only a small part of the story here.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about that all the time, that the value of, you know, a piece of software is not that pile of code over there. It's actually what the software does and all the learnings you've gone through to get there and what the roadmap for it looks like looking forward. And there's a lot more to it than just that bit of code. And in fact, I used to always challenge my own team saying that if you can't even rewrite something generally in a quarter, there's something probably wrong, unless it's a big scope thing. Like most things can be rewritten quickly if you already know exactly how they should work, you know. So, okay, so tell us more about what Handsome does. So that's your company, that's your current company, right?
Right. Yeah, so Handsome is essentially what started 9 years ago. If I was to summarize it, and I can go on forever describing what we do, but we are essentially a digital design and technology agency, and we partner with our clients, with companies from small startups to giant enterprises, to create digital brands and products. So we have a team of experienced and product designers and strategists and technologists here in Austin, and we have the distributed team of software engineers, including the team that we work with that is in Omsk, the one I was describing at the very beginning.
Yeah, so roughly what size did your org grow to? What are you working with today?
So right now we have about 35, 40 people in Austin. Out of that, specifically the engineering, the technology department is fairly small. It's just three of us. We're essentially senior technologists, and we collaborate with our partners, including the team in Omsk. The team in Omsk is, if I'm not mistaken right now, is around 30, 35 people. We had formerly split a couple of years ago, back when I was managing it, and for the purpose of this conversation, I had grown this team roughly up to 12 people or so.
So let's talk about, you know, you said the company's been around for 9 years, and I assume some people have been working with you for a pretty long time. So I want to talk about, you know, what kinds of things have you been able to do to keep engineers well engaged and growing and, you know, challenged and these kinds of things?
Sure. It's actually a really interesting question. One of the things that I enjoy to geek out about is growing the software development team that is not based in the US. Actually, the teams that are outside of the US, in my case, the team that is in Omsk, I can talk forever about how we set things up and how things have changed over time. But the nature of how we got to keep the engineers engaged and around, and actually, in fact, some of the first employees of the company back 8 years ago are still with the company. The roles had changed, but the same folks are still with the company and helping move this ship forward. What's interesting about the software development team there is that the competitive landscape is different compared to the US. So in the US, and I'll take Austin as an example, there's an incredible amount of opportunities for engineers to work at product companies, at startups. You know, there's actually a lot less agencies than there are product companies. So for most countries outside of the US, the technology, especially outside of the main centers and the capitals of the countries, the opportunities for software developers are typically working for a dev shop. You know, every once in a while there will be a local startup that may have raised money, but nowhere in the world you will find the amount of well-funded startups that there are in the US. And so it's either local companies that pay moderately well, sometimes not very well, or dev shops that pay much better that work for a company that is in turn based in the US. So they serve a product company or they serve an agency that is based in the US. So really interesting thing about how we work and how I found really interesting to keep engineers engaged is to actually break the barriers as much as possible between the team that is, in my case, was based in Omsk, and the team in Austin, especially considering that those teams were doing very different functions, and Austin was the kind of the epicenter, the center of pretty much everything that we had been doing, and our core design services. What most engineers lacked from their other experiences is the direct exposure to the other parts of the business and the other parts of the product creation outside of engineering. So there was actually a lot of interest in people being closer to design, being a part of the design process, being involved in design process. You know, there's a nightmare that perhaps every single software engineer had gone through when they are working for a dev shop. The kind of that I'm describing is that they are just receiving design files with no or very little annotations, with no ability to influence the decisions that were made,
right?
With no ability to push back on things. And you know, here's the design, go do it. And you do ridiculous things, and you know, you do things, and you understand that they're not good.
Right.
Sometimes from craft perspective, sometimes from just a reasonable what makes sense to have in a product perspective, from functionality perspective, but there's typically so much disconnect. So the way that I found that is really unique that helps getting the engineers engaged, the engineers that are nearshore, offshore, or outside of the US working for a company that is in the US, is actually breaking those barriers as much as possible and introducing engineers into the design process, giving them the ability to give direct feedback on things and designing the process of product creation that includes every single member of the team, including engineers. And because those teams typically tend to be separate from each other, remote, it's so easy to forget and just not think about the remote engineering team members.
Yeah.
And so that takes intentional work to actually build the processes that include everybody. And the same way, making sure designers are part of the engineering process, so designers have the ability to give feedback on things that were built. Perhaps certain things were built not quite right. Perhaps certain things were built, but then the designers realized that, if we change a number of things, that the experience becomes so much better. Creating those feedback loops and getting people a lot more closer together. In my scenario, when you're geographically so separated, you're culturally separated, you're separated by, we speak different languages. At home, that's where, breaking those barriers actually made such a big difference to engineers that the other opportunities that they had, even if they paid more, may have not been as compelling and as interesting because they basically had to work in a sweatshop, writing lines of code instead of being a part of product creation.
So definitely you said you're changing internal behaviors and so forth to keep the remote team in mind. Were you able to ever bring them out or cycle them over or do all hands or any of that, like where the whole company could get together sometimes?
Yeah, we've actually been, there's a number of practices that we've been trying to implement. Fortunately, we didn't get to implement all of them, but making sure we, you know, for a really long time, we actually had Friday stand-ups where both of the teams were present, or the, you know, basically the whole team was present and every single team member, regardless of their location, was present. But because of the time difference, 11 hours of time difference, was really tough. So what we ended up doing is the team in Omsk was recording their own Friday stand-up, kind of summarizing things that had gone, that happened this week, and things that they're excited about next week. And they were actually sending it over here to Austin.
Nice.
So here we would launch it on a big screen right before our stand-up. So right before our 4 p.m. stand-up. So 3:45, we would have it run on the screen. And so people would be basically exposed to hearing what's happening in the other office. And then we would have the stand-up here that we would record that we would send back. So it was kind of interesting,
cool.
not perfect because of the time difference. Like, I wish there was a way to actually make sure everybody was, you know, live. So that was Friday stand-ups. We did have quarterly all hands where everybody would call in, and we tried to make it in the morning here so that the folks in Omsk were able to join and be present and not super tired. So to have, you know, to start 8:30 a.m. or 9 a.m.
Okay, so maybe next, could you get into talking about, you know, programs for growth and professional improvement, and what does that look like in your type of company, which is a interactive agency?
Yeah, so we're not big, right? We're always small-ish in size. So it wasn't necessarily complicated, elaborate, or incredibly formal. There were a few things that we tried to standardize. There was a number of guidelines that we established, and still many things were very much ad hoc. So as an agency, especially being a small agency, things are different from a typical product company. We are small, yet we support and must be supporting an ability, internal capabilities in a number of engineering areas: web front end, back end, infrastructure, iOS and Android native development, iOS and Android web hybrid development. So all of those things with a fairly small team. So one of the internal organizational goals was increasing the bus factor, you know, the minimum number of team members that have to, you know, disappear or hit by a bus,
right?
For things to break down. And so our goal was to increase that number, and which means for us, cross-discipline training was really important.
Yeah.
So that was an organizational goal. What was interesting is for a lot of people that we hired, they actually had a lot of interest in cross-discipline training as well. So that was a big point in our professional improvement, is not necessarily going super deep into your specific practice area, but also becoming in a way generalist, right? So for us, professional growth meant in many ways that people get to learn new things from other people who may not necessarily be experts in your own field.
Right.
And so we preferred, in general, strong generalists, what people call T-shaped expert. I really like what somebody said, rake-shaped expert. So you have this one, you know, your core area that you go fairly deep into, and then there's a lot of other areas that you go somewhat deep into,
yeah,
but still generalist. And so that's what we preferred, the nature of our work, that fit it best. And so when we were hiring, in a way, we were looking for, you know, whether the kind of person we are hiring is the kind of person that wants to go really deep and do this one thing and like lock themselves in a room for, you know, 2 months and solve this really complicated problem that is very specific to some area of technology. That's not necessarily what we wanted, right? So in our case, we wanted people who are a bit more willing to be the generalists and would tend to be a little bit more entrepreneurish and business problem solvers. And then the tools with which you solve the problem would depend on what kind of problem it is and so on.
Yeah.
So one of the metrics was to make sure that at least two other people on the team are able at a given point in time perform a code review for pull request of another team member. Even if their main specialty is different, we would want to make sure their level of understanding of the of this other practice area is enough for us to have, you know, two other people to review the code or the third member. And then for things that are really deep and really complicated, we would actually typically find a contractor. We'd find somebody who's an expert who's been doing this thing for many, many years and would come with a specialized knowledge. So another organizational capability that is pretty important is that we must be comfortable as a team and capable of introducing and working with specialized experts who can come in for some limited amount of time and would either help us create something that is, you know, really complicated or mentor our team to make that thing. And so a lot of growth and professional development was circling around those things that I described that made people most effective in our organization and happened to be aligned with what many people that we hired actually liked.
Yeah, definitely. I think the theme there is like continuous improvement, right? If people are going to widen their, if the org is going to widen their buzz factor by people learning more things, you inevitably have people teaching each other stuff all the time. Another right. multiplier effect is you're bringing in the consultants and things to teach you skills. And that's great. I think that's a very healthy org, is one that's on a continuous learning, continuous improvement sort of program.
Right. Yeah, and so that's a lot of those things is kind of internal, you know, guidelines and things that we were trying to stick to. Now, we did encourage people, because we are so small, we did encourage people to go a little bit outside of the company, outside of this box, outside of our kind of bubble. And we have reasonable budget for conferences and ability to go somewhere to really cool conference, sometimes abroad, one or two times a year. So some of those yields professional improvement, often that yields just better morale and motivation and happiness in general. It's ideal yeah. if it's a combination of the two. It's just perfect. But also in one-on-ones, when I work with my team members, I try to make sure they put an emphasis on going outside this bubble and going to meetups and community gatherings and just talking to other people, just not yeah. being stuck in how we do things and learning how other people do things. But also something I've been trying to help with is finding the experts and mentors in my network, in their network. But I truly believe every single person should have a mentor who has
Definitely.
Gone through the same challenges that this person had gone. Ideally, they have a number of peers as well with whom they can share their challenges and so on. So if you cannot find those people inside the company, for a small company like ours, it's important to encourage people to find those people outside of the company.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good advice right there.
And lastly, one other area of professional development for our engineers in Omsk was to get them to understand the design process. That's not something they get to be exposed to very often. And I'm not just talking visual design, I'm talking about the capital D design, product design, experience design, service design, and so on, all of those things that come into creating a successful product. And so many engineers have very little understanding of how that's happening. And I found that so many engineers were actually so interested in learning that. And so an opportunity to have an engineer from OMS to come over to the US to spend a few weeks there, which in itself is a big deal for a lot of people who were born and raised outside of the US. It's for some people, it's a dream to come visit and see what it's like in the United States. But also to be collaborating in person, to be a part of the team, to be part of a project design team here in person, was a big thing for what people consider to be a really important professional step in their career and what they valued so much. And so we got a chance to have a couple of senior team members from OMSC visit our Austin office a few times. That was really incredible and really good.
Yeah, so I'm wondering what happens when with inside your org you get to those points where you get friction. Maybe it's because of deadlines or budget or those kinds of constraints. How do you keep these programs going when you're under tight consideration?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of things that were making this whole thing a little bit more difficult, especially with the development team that was not co-located. It is incredibly difficult to have a remote collaboration happening when most of work is happening co-located, and then one portion of work is happening with the collaboration with the remote team. And so from an individual contributor level on every single project, the challenge was more of making sure people are intentional and are considerate of remote team members. And so if that was not happening well, and if that was not happening right, that affected people's happiness and engagement, and that affected, you know, with engineers, that basically made their life a little bit less enjoyable when it comes to work, and right, they were right. less motivated. And so that was like from individual level, a contributor level, there's the work that basically every head of each practice area here in Austin had to work with their team, and each project manager had to make sure. So it is a lot of work. Looking from the business perspective, from organization perspective, budget was one of the serious considerations. Conferences were not that big of a challenge and problem. In fact, the budget we had for conferences, people rarely exceeded. Hmm. Now, when it came to travel, and specifically travel between the two countries and people to get to go to the other office to spend time with the team, whether it's engineers coming to Austin or designers or other team members going to OMSC, that was probably the biggest challenge, because that specific route is fairly expensive. Lodging is not cheap. And just the logistics around that are disruptive to the activities in the office and activities on projects, because the travel is fairly long. It takes in total more than 24 hours with all the overlays to get to the destination. So,
wow.
Partially the challenge is both budget and from just timing perspective. And you know, when somebody flies that long and has a 11-hour time difference, they need to adapt. So a couple of more days is like fighting the jet lag and trying to get back into the productive state. So combination of those factors, but budget being probably the biggest one with which we struggle, is just making sure we do allocate the budget. And again, being a small agency, it had always been difficult and challenging for us to make this happen. It was incredible and great when we were able to make it happen. And when we couldn't make it happen, We just had to be a lot more intentional, put a lot more effort into remote collaboration and getting this exposure to the other office and to what the other team is doing through remote means.
Great. So far we've been talking about growth, which you could argue growth and career pathing are sort of two sides of the same coin because they both involve each other. And in fact, without growth, you're not going to move along in your career path. But why don't we actually switch gears and talk a bit about what you're doing to manage an individual's overall arc. You know, they start with you at a certain level, and then through the years, they're leveling up and getting different levels of engineering excellence. Maybe it's management. Talk about how you're managing every individual's career path within your org.
Yeah, really good question. I think within a small organization, it may be more challenging than in a larger organization because there's not always a lot of opportunities for people to grow. You know, sometimes there's just not a role available, or there's just you know, for the career path that an employee for the career path that a team member expects, sometimes there's just not a not an organizational alignment in that career path is something that works for us. In general, though, something that we had done is building out what we call the competency matrix, which is basically trying to formalize what we assume and expect a junior developer is, what a middle-level developer is, what a senior developer is, and then what a principal developer and a technical director are. And so I'm actually looking at the spreadsheet right now. You know, imagine a spreadsheet with the columns with all of those different levels, and then the rows that we identified are collaboration and teamwork, technical breadth, hard skills, development skills, conflict management, ability to prioritize and workload management, leadership skills, business development capabilities, interdisciplinary collaboration expectations, and billability. So the last one is not necessarily something that the, you know, the skill of a person as much as it is understanding where a certain type of position is when we engage in work with our client. And so a set of those things. So that, imagine that math matrix. And so we filled out each of the cells on the intersections of each type of role and each characteristic. And so that had created a set of expectations that we have for different roles, and that made it so much easier for us to make an informed decision about what type of role we can offer to a person who we're interviewing, or what kind of person we should be, or what kind of role we should be interviewing for a certain type of project or for a certain type of engagement.
Cool. So when you're growing your team in Omsk, how does that happen? Is it word of mouth? Is it a small community? So like, how do you get your new technology team members on board out there?
Great question. So I'm actually very lucky that the person who leads the office is very involved in the community. He is the head of Google Developers Group in Omsk. He's very involved with the Google community and the developers who are all in Google community. But he had also been either organizing or participating in many local conferences. So his personal network is pretty incredible. But there's a lot of word of mouth. So what I described before about how, in a way, unique what we can offer software developers is that people tend to tell other people about it, and people, you know, people just tend to send, you know, unsolicited emails. And to me, you know, a metric, you know, a really good sign is when you receive unsolicited emails, meaning there's not a job opening, but people send you emails and asking, and you know, sending you their resume and asking if you have any positions available or asking you to, you know, meet up for coffee.
So you're saying they receive unsolicited applicants to the company?
Right.
Oh, that's a good sign. Yeah, that's a great problem to have. Wow. Okay, so could you talk about some of the different roles that you have in your company? I think what's a little unique about your org compared to some of the others is that you're an agency model. So how do the roles differ in what you have in your organization?
Yeah, great question. Just like in many companies, we have the normal junior, middle, senior, principal, director type of positions for software engineers. There's one other role that we had instituted that is kind of interesting, and I found how we shape it over time really, really interesting. We call it technologist. So a technologist is essentially a somebody who comes out of being a middle or senior level developer or principal developer with a lot of experience building products, building software. So they know what it's like, but they want to move on. They are perhaps burnt out, or they just don't like it anymore. They just don't feel like they want to continue to write code 24/7, you know, or like 100% of their job. At the same time, they're not necessarily looking to move into a, you know, product management sort of position. They still want to be perhaps an individual contributor on the project. And so for us, a technologist role is a really interesting role in that the core of our offerings is design. You know, I call it capital D design. There's a lot in that. And the role of technologist is to take the knowledge of technology, the tactical knowledge of how what it takes to build things, and bring it into the design team. So actually being a part of the design team, sort of a technology consultant on the design team, also wear a hat of a designer. So be a part of everything from research and discovery activities and user interviews and definition of personas and definition kind of ideation and definition of the product and MVP of the product might be, and be the technologist in the room. What we have struggled with in the past is that not having that technologist in the room is difficult. And sometimes results in certain decisions that we wish we had made differently. And bringing in a software engineer was not always the answer. Like taking a software engineer who wants to code. I mean, that, you know, most software engineers want them to be kind of left alone and they want to build things. Now, this role is specifically for the people who don't want to be, you know, building things full time, and they want actually to be involved in the other parts of what it takes to design and build a product. And so that's a connective tissue between all of the design activities, and that is the person that helps onboard the team of software engineers to build the thing, to build this product.
Cool. So what I'd like to do now is move on to the wild card round. This time around, we're going to talk about potentially awkward or weird interview experiences that you've had, either giving or receiving. I guess since you've always been at the top of your orgs, I'm not sure if you've interviewed at a lot of places, but perhaps maybe some of the ones that you've conducted, et cetera.
Yeah, I've actually never been on a formal interview as an interviewee. which sounds really interesting. But I had interviewed a lot of people. I found that most awkward and most weird interviews come out of interviewing the remote team members and people who are, you know, it's when you're complicated, when the person right. comes into the room, you know, there's so much more. There's, you know, all the nonverbal kind of language that is happening. When things are remote, and the example I'm going to give is actually, you know, it's not just awkward, but there's so much of people trying to play some sort of trick on you and claim to be not what they are or who they are.
Yeah.
And over time, I had built the kind of a sense to see that early on from just looking at the profile. And, you know, if we find a remote team member, a contractor on something like Upwork or it used to be called Odesk, from the profile and past works, I can typically filter out, you know, 90% of what is just does not look right. Then very recently, in fact, a month ago, we had been getting on a call to interview this guy who claimed to be from Ukraine. And I speak Russian, and Ukrainian and Russian are very close languages. You know, most people in Ukraine know Russian and so on. So, but on my team, I had the American team members. So we started talking in English. A photo of the person was a little bit surprisingly, to some extent, an Asian person, which is somewhat uncommon, you know, in Ukraine. But, you know, I'm not trying to be presumptive or like trying to make any,
sure.
You know, anything out of it. So the resume was really impressive. The types of work that the person had done was really impressive. The name was a very kind of Russian Ukrainian name. So it didn't have all that many concerns. And we had made it a standard practice before we get on the interview to ask for an example of code, something that they have written, a hobby project or a small piece of a project that they built recently, so that we can have something to talk about. You know, just the first filter of making sure they know what they're doing. So they sent us a zip file with a bunch of you know, React code. We're getting on the call, we all have video on. That person doesn't have video on, and from the first words, I'm realizing that the accent of that person is clearly not Russian or Ukrainian. Hmm. It's clearly very Asian, and I still don't know, perhaps Chinese or Philippine from the Philippines. And what I also start to hear in the background is, there's a lot of other people seemingly talking on the phone as well.
Right, right. These are called bait and switch.
Yeah, right. So
switched candidates, you know.
Right. So it started sounding like call center. And again, we're trying to be not presumptuous and actually conduct the interview. You know, what if this person who claims to be a software developer with really good, you know, portfolio resume is, you know, exactly that. And a first basic question about the code base, about the code structure, like something like, just tell us about the structure of your, you know, React component, something of that sort. The guy just stumps, takes like 2 minutes to think, and then starts to chat with someone in the room without muting in the language that is clearly not English or Russian or Ukrainian.
Right.
And they seemingly collaboratively are trying to come up with an answer to this question. Well, we promptly finished the call, but that reminded me of how that, you know, how often that, you know, that is actually a thing, and how often that it's wasting a lot of, you know, gets us to, you know, waste a lot of time. Actually, before this interview, I looked at tried to find the profile of that person, and it was deleted from the platform. So, presumably, you know, somebody in the platform had looked at the reports and deleted the profile. But Yeah,
that's
the story that I've had many times.
I had a similar one where I was interviewing someone who was a teacher at a coding school, presumably, and I could tell a couple of things that were similar to what you said. Number one, they were interviewing with me in a room full of people, but they're all trying to be quiet. But you could tell like the small little noises people make and the rustling and like when it's not the speaker, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then through the process, we're like, okay, cool. We're going to advance this person to the next round. And we got pretty far through the process, even past like a coding pairing or coding test or whatever, or code pairing, you know, code sim. And towards the end, they're like, sorry, I'm not interested now, but here's my colleague over here. Why don't you go with them? And it's like, we never even would have chosen that other person, you know. So it was kind of a little bit disingenuous, you know, like a switched candidate. Recruiters try and do that stuff too. But do you have any other interesting stories on the interviewing side with talent or with recruiters? Any of those?
Nothing that comes to mind right now. I mean, there's. I mean, interviewed a lot of people here in Austin, and interviewed a lot of people in Omsk in person, interviewed a lot of people remote. There's always a variety of things. I think the most difficult for me and the most awkward for me is when the person has a very strong perception that they are an incredibly strong and experienced developer in some sort of technology. And when you ask the questions related to this technology, the way they reply, you can clearly see that they don't have all that much experience. You know, my specialty was front end back when, you know, React and frameworks were not a thing, but HTML and CSS and the building highly, custom, highly interactive websites, which is essentially mastering HTML and CSS and creatively building things for that, was the main thing you do in front-end development. And then today, interviewing people who claim that they know HTML and CSS extensively, I typically find that their level of HTML and CSS proficiency is good enough to build most digital products, but it's not, you know, 10 out of 10 how they describe it. And so the most awkward for me personally, and I still struggle with that, is turning it from them self assessing it as 10 out of 10 and describing it and getting them to understand that that's not necessarily the case. So to me, those kind of conversations can get awkward.
Yeah, to me, for me, that's how you look for humility, because it's like, well, how do you self-assess yourself? You know, are you really an expert or a master at these things? And you'll even see that with folks that are early in their career. They've only been at it for 3 years and now they're a senior developer or whatever. People will self-title too soon as well. And maybe they had that role somewhere, there was actually a famous Stanford University professor. And when you took their class, they let you just grade yourself. They let you grade your final and give yourself a grade in the class. And this was that same conundrum. It's like, you know, do you just give yourself an A+ out of hand, or you just have to justify why you got it, right? Well, all right, Alex, thanks so much for your time today. This has been a great conversation. So thanks for coming on and talking about your history and how you grew your team and some of the things that were important to you about that.
Thank you, Dave. I really enjoyed our conversation.